Epilogue. The Crimean War in Myth and Memory. The end of the Crimean War was marked by modest festivities in Britain. There was a general disappointment that peace had come before the troops had scored a major victory to equal that of the French at Sevastopol, and that they had failed to carry out a broader war against Russia. Mixed with this sense of failure was a feeling of outrage and national shame at the blunders of the government and military authorities. "I own that peace rather sticks in my throat," Queen Victoria noted in her journal on the 11th of March, "and so it does in that of the whole nation." There was no great victory parade in London, no official ceremony to welcome home the troops, who arrived at Woolwich looking very sunburnt, according to the Queen. Watching several boatloads of soldiers disembark on the 13th of March, she thought they were the picture of real fighting men. Such fine, tall, strong men, some strikingly handsome, all with such proud, noble, soldier-like bearing. They all had long beards and were heavily laden with large knapsacks, their cloaks and blankets on the top, canteens and full haversacks, and carrying their muskets. But if there were no joyous celebrations, there were memorials. Literally hundreds of commemorative plaques and monuments, paid for in the main by groups of private individuals and erected in memory of lost and fallen soldiers in church graveyards, regimental barracks, hospitals and schools, city halls and museums, on town squares and village greens across the land. Of the 98,000 British soldiers and sailors sent to the Crimea, more than one in five did not return. 20,813 men died in the campaign, 80% of them from sickness or disease. Reflecting this public sense of loss and admiration for the suffering troops, the government commissioned a Guards Memorial to commemorate the heroes of the Crimean War. John Bell's massive ensemble, three bronze guardsmen, Coldstream, Fusilier and Grenadier, cast from captured Russian cannon and standing guard beneath the classical figure of honour, was unveiled on Waterloo Place at the intersection of Lower Regent Street and Pall Mall in London in 1861. Opinion was divided on the monument's artistic qualities. Londoners referred to the figure of honour as the quoits player, because the oak leaf coronels in her outstretched arms resembled the rings used in that game. Many thought the monument lacked the grace and beauty needed for a site of such significance. Count Gleichen later said that it looked best in the fog, but its symbolic impact was unprecedented. It was the first war memorial in Britain to raise to hero status the ordinary troops. The Crimean War brought about a sea change in Britain's attitudes towards its fighting men. It laid the basis of the modern national myth built on the idea of the soldier defending the nation's honour, right and liberty. Before the war, the idea of military honour was defined by aristocracy. Gallantry and valour were attained by high-born martial leaders like the Duke of York, the son of George III, and commander of the British Army against Napoleon, whose column was erected in 1833, 5 years after the Duke's death, from the funds raised by deducting one day's pay from every soldier in the army. Military paintings featured the heroic exploits of dashing noble officers, but the common soldier was ignored. Placing the Guards Memorial opposite the Duke of York's column was symbolic of a fundamental shift in Victorian values. It represented a challenge to the leadership of the aristocracy, which had been so discredited by the military blunders in the Crimea. If the British military hero had previously been a gentleman, all plumed and laced, now he was a trooper, the Private Smith or Tommy Atkins of folklore, who fought courageously and won Britain's wars in spite of the blunders of his generals. Here was a narrative that ran through British history from the Crimean to the First and Second World Wars and beyond to the wars of recent times. As Private Smith of the Black Watch wrote in 1899 after a defeat for the British Army in the Boer War, "Such was the day for our regiment. Dread the revenge we will take. Dearly we paid for the blunder, a drawing-room general's mistake. Why weren't we told of the trenches? Why weren't we told of the wire? Why were we marched up in column? May Tommy Atkins inquire. As the American writer Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote in his English notebooks, the year of 1854 had done the work of 50 ordinary ones in undermining aristocracy. The war's mismanagement also triggered a new assertiveness in the middle classes, which rallied round the principles of professional competence, industry, meritocracy, and self-reliance in opposition to the privilege of birth. The Crimean War had furnished them with plenty of examples of professional initiatives having come to the rescue of the badly managed military campaign, the nursing work of Florence Nightingale, the culinary expertise of Alexis Soyer, Samuel Peto's Balaclava Railway, or Joseph Paxton's navvies, who were sent to build the wooden huts that sheltered British soldiers from a second winter on the Sevastopol Heights. Thanks to the press, to which they wrote with their practical advice and opinions, the middle classes became actively involved in the daily running of the war. Politically, they were the real victors, since by its end, the war was being run on professional principles. It was a sign of their triumph that in the decades afterwards, Whig, Conservative, and Liberal governments alike all passed reforms promoting middle-class ideals, the extension of the franchise to the professional and artisan classes, freedom of the press, greater openness and accountability in government, meritocracy, religious toleration, public education, and a more caring attitude towards the labouring classes and deserving poor, which had its origin in, among other things, a concern for the suffering of the soldiers during the Crimean War. That concern was the impetus for a series of army reforms brought in by Lord Cardwell, Gladstone's War Minister, between 1868 and 1871. The purchase of commissions was replaced by a merit-based system of promotions. The period of enlistment for privates was dramatically reduced, pay and conditions were improved, and flogging was abolished in peacetime. The newfound confidence of the British middle classes was epitomised by Florence Nightingale. She returned from the Crimea as a national heroine, and her image was sold widely on commemorative postcards, figurines, and medallions to the public. Punch depicted her as Britannia, carrying a lamp rather than a shield, a lancet rather than a lance, and in verse suggested that she was more worthy of the public's adoration than any dashing noble officer. The floating froth of public praise, blown lightly by each random gust, settles on trophies bright for days, to lapse in centuries of rust. The public heart that will be fed, but has no art its food to choose, grasps what comes readiest, stones for bread, rather than fast will not refuse. Hence hero worship's hungry haste takes meanest idols, tawdriest shrines, where cardigan struts plumed and laced, or Hudson in brass lacquer shines. Yet when on top of common breaths a truly glorious name is flung, scorn not because so many wreaths before unworthiest shrines are hung. The people, howe'er wild or weak, have noble instinct still to guide, oft find false gods when true they seek, but true once found have ne'er denied. And now, for all that's ill-bestowed or rash in popular applause, deep and true England's heart has glowed in this great woman's holy cause. In popular plays and drawing-room ballads, Nightingale's patriotic dedication and professionalism served to compensate for the damage done to national pride by the recognition that stupidity and mismanagement had caused greater suffering to the soldiers than anything inflicted by the enemy. In one play, The War in Turkey, produced in the Britannia Saloon in London, for example, there was a series of comic scenes ridiculing the incompetence of the British authorities, followed by a scene in which Miss Bird, Nightingale, appears and sorts out all the problems left behind. The scene ends with a moral lesson. In that young lady we behold true heroism. The heart that beats in her bosom is capable of any heroic deed. The legend of the Lady with the Lamp became part of Britain's national myth, retold in countless histories, schoolbooks, and biographies of Florence Nightingale. It contained the basic elements of the middle-class Victorian ideal, a Christian narrative about womanly care, good works, and self-sacrifice, a moral one of self-improvement and the salvation of the deserving poor, a domestic tale of cleanliness, good housekeeping, and the improvement of the home, a story about individual determination and the assertion of the will that appealed to professional aspirations, and a public narrative of sanitary and hospital reform to which Nightingale would dedicate herself for the rest of her long life after her return from the Crimea. In 1915, when Britain was at war again, this time with Russia on its side, a statue of the Lady of the Lamp was added to the Crimean War Memorial, which was moved back towards Regent Street to accommodate the new figure. The statue of Nightingale was joined by one brought in from the War Office of a thoughtful Sidney Herbert, the Secretary at War, who had sent her to the Crimea. It was belated public recognition for a man who had been hounded out of office during the Crimea War, partly on account of his family connections to Russia. On a sunny Friday morning, the 26th of June 1857, the Queen and Prince Albert attended a parade of Crimean veterans in Hyde Park. By a royal warrant the previous January, the Queen had instituted a new medal, the Victoria Cross, to reward bravery by servicemen regardless of their class or rank. Other European countries had long had such awards. The French, the Légion d'Honneur, since 1802, the Dutch, the Military Order of William, and even the Russians had a merit medal before 1812. In Britain, however, there was no system of military honours to recognise the bravery of the troops on the basis of merit, only one to reward officers. The war reports by Russell of the Times and other journalists had brought to the attention of the British public many acts of bravery by ordinary troops. They had portrayed the suffering of the soldiers in heroic terms, giving rise to a widespread feeling that a new award was needed to recognise their deeds. 62 Crimean veterans were chosen to receive the first Victoria Crosses, a small bronze medal supposed to be cast from the captured Russian cannon of Sevastopol. At the ceremony in Hyde Park, each one took his turn to bow before the Queen as Lord Panmure, Secretary of State for War, read out his name and gave the citation for gallantry. Among these first recipients of Britain's highest military honour were 16 privates from the army, 4 gunners and 1 sapper, 2 seamen and 3 boatswains. The institution of the Victoria Cross not only confirmed the change in the idea of heroism, it also marked a new reverence for war and warriors. The troops who had received the Victoria Cross found their deeds commemorated in a multitude of post-war books that exalted the bravery of men-at-arms. The most popular, Our Soldiers and the Victoria Cross, was brought out by Samuel Beaton, best known as the publisher of his wife's book, Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management, in 1861. Written to inspire and teach boys, the preface of Our Soldiers claimed, "Boys, worthy to be called boys, are naturally brave. What visions are those which rise up before the young? What brave words to speak, what brave actions to do, how bravely, if need be, to suffer. This is the leading thought in this book about soldiers. It is meant to keep alive the bravery of youth in the experience of manhood." This didactic cult of manliness animated the 2 major British novels set against the background of the Crimean War, Charles Kingsley's 2 years ago, 1857, and Henry Kingsley's Ravenshoe, 1861. It was also the pervading theme of Charles Kingsley's Westward Ho, 1855, a New World adventure story set at the time of the Spanish Armada, which was inspired by the militarism and xenophobia of Britain during the Crimean War. Its author himself described it in 1854 as "a most ruthless and bloodthirsty book, just what the times want, I think." The argument for war was also at the heart of Thomas Hughes's hugely influential novel Tom Brown's School Days, 1857, whose most famous scene, the fight between Tom and the bully Slogger Williams, was clearly meant to be read by the public as a moral lesson on the recent war against Russia. From the cradle to the grave, fighting, rightly understood, is the business, the real, highest, honestest business of every son of man. Everyone who is worth his salt has his enemies who must be beaten, be they evil thoughts and habits in himself, or spiritual wickednesses in high places, or Russians, or border ruffians, or Bill, Tom, or Harry, who will not let him live his life in quiet till he has thrashed them. It is no good for Quakers or any other body of men to uplift their voices against fighting. Human nature is too strong for them, and they don't follow their own precepts. Every soul of them is doing his own piece of fighting somehow and somewhere. The world might be a better place without fighting, for anything I know, but it wouldn't be our world, and therefore I am dead against crying peace when there is no peace and isn't meant to be. Saying no to a challenge to fight is a proof of the highest courage if done from true Christian motives. It's quite right and justifiable if done from a simple aversion to physical pain and danger. But don't say no because you fear a licking, and say or think it's because you fear God, for that's neither Christian nor honest. Here was the original cult of muscular Christianity, the notion of Christian soldiers fighting righteous wars that came to define the Victorian imperial mission. This was a time when Britons began to sing in church, "Onward, Christian soldiers, marching as to war, with the cross of Jesus going on before. Christ, the royal master, leads against the foe. Forward into battle, see his banners go." 1864. The argument for muscular Christianity was first made in a review of Kingsley's novel 2 years ago in 1857, a year when the idea of the Christian soldier was reinforced by the actions of the British troops in putting down the Indian Mutiny. But the idea of training boys to fight for Christian causes was also prominent in Hughes's sequel to Tom Brown's School Days, Tom Brown at Oxford, 1861, where athletic sport is extolled as a builder of manly character, teamwork, chivalry, and moral fortitude, qualities that had made Britons good at war. The least of the muscular Christians has hold of the old chivalrous and Christian belief that a man's body is given him to be trained and brought into subjection, and then used for the protection of the weak, the advancement of all righteous causes, and the subduing of the earth which God has given to the children of men. At the heart of this ideal was a new concentration on physical training and the mastery of the body as a form of moral strengthening for the purposes of holy war. It was a quality associated with the hardiness of the suffering soldiers in the Crimea. But that suffering, too, played a role in transforming the public image of the British troops. Before the war, the respectable middle and upper classes had viewed the rank and file of the British Army as little more than a dissolute rabble, heavy drinking and ill-disciplined, brutal and profane, drawn from the poorest sections of society. But the agonies of the soldiers in the Crimea had revealed their Christian souls and turned them into objects of good works and evangelical devotion. Religious ministering to the rank and file dramatically increased during the war. The army doubled its number of chaplains, and every man was given a Bible free of charge, courtesy of middle-class donations to the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge and the Naval and Military Bible Society. The soldiers were recast as saintly figures, martyrs of a holy cause in the eyes of many evangelicals. Among them was Catherine Marsh, whose lively and sentimental hagiography, Memorials of Captain Hedley Vickers, 97th Regiment, 1856, sold more than 100,000 copies in its first few years of publication and reappeared in numerous abridged and juvenile editions up until the First World War. Compiled from Vickers' diary and his letters to his mother from the Crimea, Memorials was dedicated to the noble ideal of the Christian soldier and offered to the public as a fresh and ample refutation to those who, in the face of examples to the contrary, still maintain that entire devotion of the heart to God must withdraw a man from many of the active duties of life, and that in making a good Christian you may spoil a good soldier. Vickers is portrayed as a soldier saint, a selfless hero who bears the burdens of his fellow men on the Sevastopol Heights by sharing his food and tent, caring for them, and reading them the Bible when they are sick. Vickers leads his men to holy war against the Russians, who are described as heathens, infidels, and savages. He is mortally wounded during the sortie of 22nd to 23rd of March 1855, and his death is compared to the martyrdom of Christ in Marsh's final chapter, Victory, which is prefaced by Longfellow's verse, a translation from the Spanish poet Jorge Manrique. His soul to him who gave it rose, God led it to its long repose, its glorious rest. And though the warrior's sun has set, its light shall longer round us yet, bright, radiant, blessed. Vickers was buried in Sevastopol, but in St. George's Church on Bromley Road in Beckenham, Kent, there is a white marble tablet carved in the shape of a scroll with a sheathed sword behind, on which these words are inscribed. To the glory of God, and to the beloved memory of Hedley Vickers, Captain 97th Regiment, who, through faith in the word of God, that the blood of Jesus Christ his Son cleanseth us all in sin, passed from the death of sin to the life of righteousness. He fell in battle and slept in Jesus on the night of the 22nd of March 1855, and was buried before Sevastopol, aged 28 years. Beyond the sanctification of soldiers and the new manly ideal, the common effort of the war seemed to offer the possibility of national unity and reconciliation needed to end the class divisions and industrial strife of the 1830s and 1840s. In Dickens's Household Words, alongside the serialisation of Elizabeth Gaskell's North and South, 1855, a novel on the theme of ending the class conflict, there appeared a series of poems by Adelaide Ann Procter, Queen Victoria's favourite poet, including The Lesson of the War. The rulers of the nation, the poor ones at their gate, with the same eager wonder, the same great news await. The poor man's stay and comfort, the rich man's joy and pride, upon the bleak Crimean shore, a fighting side by side. A similar idea can be found in Tennyson's poetic monodrama, Maud, 1855, where a state of civil war, created by the lust of gain at home, gives way to an ending in which the narrator looks to war abroad as a higher and more godly cause. Let it go or stay, so I wake to the higher aims of a land that has lost for a little her lust of gold, and love of a peace that was full of wrongs and shames, horrible, hateful, monstrous, not to be told, and hail once more to the banner of battle unrolled. Though many a light shall darken, and many shall weep for those that are crushed in the clash of jarring claims, yet God's just wrath shall be wreaked on a giant lyre, and many a darkness into the light shall leap, and shine in the sudden making of splendid names, a noble thought be freer under the sun, and the heart of a people beat with one desire. For the peace that I deemed no peace is over and done, and now, by the side of the black and the Baltic deep, and deathful grinning mouths of the fortress, flames the blood-red blossom of war with a heart of fire. Let it flame or fade, and the war roll down like a wind. We have proved we have hearts in a cause, we are noble still, and myself have awaked, as it seems, to the better mind. It is better to fight for the good than to rail at the ill. I have felt with my native land, I am one with my kind. I embrace the purpose of God and the doom assigned. Painters picked up the same theme in John Gilbert's Her Majesty the Queen Inspecting the Wounded Coldstream Guards in the Hall of Buckingham Palace, 1856, a painting sadly lost that was popular enough to be reproduced as a coloured lithograph as late as 1903, there is a touching poignancy in the meeting between the Queen and the wounded heroes of the Crimea, which suggests the prospect of post-war unity between the highest and lowest of the land. Jerry Barrett's large painting, Queen Victoria's First Visit to Her Wounded Soldiers, 1856, played on this emotion too. This sentimental picture of the royal family visiting Crimean invalids at the Chatham Army Hospital was such a success when it was first shown at Thomas Agnew's gallery in Piccadilly that several thousand prints were subsequently sold to the public in various editions, costing between 3 and 10 guineas. The Queen herself was a collector of photographic souvenirs of Crimean veterans. She commissioned commercial photographers like Joseph Cundall and Robert Howlett to make a series of commemorative portraits of maimed and wounded soldiers in various military hospitals, including Chatham, for the Royal Collection at Windsor. Cundall and Howlett's striking photographs reached beyond their patronesses' hands. Through photographic expeditions and their reproduction in the illustrated press, they brought home to the public in explicit terms the suffering of the soldiers and the human costs of war. These pioneering photographs were very different from Fenton's genteel images. In Cundall and Howlett's Three Crimean Invalids, 1855, for example, the wounded infantrymen are seated on a hospital bed displaying their loss of limbs. There is no emotion in their expressions, no romanticism or sentimentality in their representation, only the documentary evidence in black and white of the impact made by iron shot and frostbite on the body. In their notes in the Royal Archives, Cundall and Howlett identified the men as William Young of the 23rd Regiment, wounded at the Redan on the 18th of June 1855, Henry Burland of the 34th, both legs lost to frostbite in the trenches before Sevastopol, and John Connery of the 49th, his left leg lost to frostbite in the trenches. Memories of the Crimean War continued to provide a winning subject for British artists well into the 1870s. The best known of these Crimean pictures was Calling the Roll After an Engagement, Crimea, 1874, by Elizabeth Thompson, Lady Butler, which caused a sensation when it was exhibited at the Royal Academy. So great were the crowds that came to see it that a policeman was put on guard to provide protection. Already known for her earlier paintings on military themes, Thompson had conceived the roll call, as it became popularly known, in the immediate aftermath of the Cardwell reforms, when army matters were prominent in public life. From detailed sketches of Crimean veterans, she created a striking composition in which the remnants of the grenadiers, wounded, cold and utterly exhausted, assemble after a battle to be counted by their mounted officer. The painting was completely different from conventional depictions of war that focused on the glorious deeds of gallant officers. Apart from the mounted officer, the 2-metre-high canvas was entirely dominated by the suffering of the rank and file. It stripped away the heroics and let the viewer look into the face of war. After its showing at the Royal Academy, the roll call went on national tour, drawing immense crowds. In Newcastle, it was advertised by men with sandwich boards, which simply read, "The roll call is coming." In Liverpool, 20,000 people saw the picture in 3 weeks, a huge number for the time. People came away profoundly moved by the painting, which had clearly touched the nation's heart. The Queen purchased the roll call from its original buyer, a Manchester industrialist, but a printing company retained the right to reproduce it in a popular edition of engravings. Thompson herself became a national heroine overnight. A 250,000 carte de visite photographs of the artist were sold to the public, who put her on a par with Florence Nightingale. What will they say in England when the story there is told, of deeds of might on Alma's height done by the brave and bold, of Russia proud at noontide, humbled ere set of sun. They'll say 'twas like old England, they'll say 'twas nobly done. What will they say in England when hushed in awe and dread, fond hearts through all our happy homes think of the mighty dead, and muse in speechless anguish on father, brother, son? They'll say in dear old England, God's holy will be done. What will they say in England, our names both night and day are in their hearts and on their lips when they laugh or weep or pray? They watch the earth, they plead with heaven, then forward to the fight. Who droops or fears while England cheers and God defends the right? Reverend J.S.B. Monsell in The Girls' Reading Book, 1875. The Crimean War left a deep impression on the English national identity. To school children, it was an example of England standing up against the Russian bear to defend liberty, a simple fight between right and might, as Punch portrayed it at the time. The idea of John Bull coming to the aid of the weak against tyrants and bullies became part of Britain's essential narrative. Many of the same emotive forces that took Britain to the Crimean War were again at work when Britain went to war against the Germans in defence of Little Belgium in 1914 and Poland in 1939. Today, the names of Alma, Balaclava, Inkerman, Sebastopol, Cardigan and Raglan continue to inhabit the collective memory, mainly through the signs of streets and pubs. For decades after the Crimean War, there was a fashion for naming girls Florence, Alma, Balaclava, and boys Inkerman. Veterans of the war took these names to every corner of the world. There is a town called Balaclava in South Australia and another in Queensland. There are Inkermans in West Virginia, South and West Australia, Queensland, Victoria, and New South Wales in Australia, as well as Gloucester County, Canada. There are Sebastopols in California, Ontario, New South Wales and Victoria, and a Mount Sebastopol in New Zealand. There are four towns called Alma in Wisconsin, one in Colorado, two in Arkansas, and 10 others in the United States. Four Almas and a lake with the same name in Canada, two towns called Alma in Australia, and a river by that name in New Zealand. In France, too, the names of the Crimea are found everywhere, reminders of a war in which 310,000 Frenchmen were involved. One in three did not return home. Paris has an Alma Bridge, built in 1856 and rebuilt in the 1970s, which is now mainly famous for the scene of Princess Diana's fatal car crash in 1997. Until then, it was better known for its Zouave statue, the only one of four to be kept from the old bridge, by which water levels are still measured by Parisians. The river is declared unnavigable when the water passes the Zouave's knees. Paris has a Place de l'Alma and a Boulevard de Sebastopol, both with metro stations by those names. There is a whole suburb in the south of Paris, originally built as a separate town, with the name of Malakoff, Malakoff. Initially called New California, Malakoff was developed in the decade after the Crimean War on cheap quarry land in the Vanves Valley by Alexandre Chauvelot, the most successful of the property developers in 19th century France. Chauvelot cashed in on the brief French craze for commemorating the Crimean victory by building pleasure gardens in the new suburb to increase its appeal to artisans and workers from the overcrowded centre of Paris. The main attraction of the gardens was the Malakoff Tower, a castle built in the image of the Russian bastion, set in a theme park of ditches, hills, redoubts and grottos, along with a bandstand and an outside theatre, where huge crowds gathered to watch the reenactments of Crimean battles or to take in other entertainment in the summer months. It was with the imprimatur of Napoleon that New California was renamed Malakoff in order of his regime's first great military victory in 1858. Developed as private building plots, the suburb grew rapidly during the 1860s, but after the defeat of France by Prussia in 1870, the Malakoff Tower was destroyed on the orders of the mayor of Vanves, who thought it was a cruel reminder of a more glorious past. Malakoff Towers were built in towns and villages throughout provincial France. Many of them survive to this day. There are Malakoff Towers in Sivry-Courtrai, Seine-et-Marne, Thury-Lurcy, Nièvre, Saint-Mizel, Yonne, Nantes and Saint-Arnaud-Montrond, Cher, as well as in Belgium at Disson and Hasselt-Cherat near Liège, Luxembourg and Germany, Cologne, Bochum and Hanover, Algeria, Oran and Algiers, and Recife in Brazil, a city colonised by the French after the Crimean War. In France itself, nearly every town has its Rue Malakoff. The French have given the name of Malakoff to public squares and parks, hotels, restaurants, cheeses, champagnes, roses and chansons. But despite these allusions, the war left much less of a trace on the French national consciousness than it did on the British. The memory of the Crimean War in France was soon overshadowed by the war in Italy against the Austrians, 1859, the French expedition to Mexico, 1862-6, and, above all, the defeat in the Franco-Prussian War. Today, the Crimean War is little known in France. It is a forgotten war. In Italy and Turkey, as in France, the Crimean War was eclipsed by later wars and quickly dropped out of the nationalist myths and narratives that came to dominate the way these countries reconstructed their 19th-century history. In Italy, there are very few landmarks to remind Italians of their country's part in the Crimean War. Even in Piedmont, where one might expect to see the war remembered, there is very little to commemorate the 2,166 soldiers who were killed in the fighting or died from disease, according to official statistics, although the actual number was almost certainly higher. In Turin, there is a Corso Sebastopoli and a Via Cernia, in memory of the only major battle in which the Italians took part. The nationalist painter, Gerolamo Induno, who went with the Sardinian troops to the Crimea and made many sketches of the fighting there, painted several battle scenes on his return in 1855, including the Battle of the Chernaya, commissioned by Victor Emmanuel II, and the capture of the Malakoff Tower, both of which excited patriotic sentiment for a few years in northern Italy. But the War of 1859 and everything that happened afterwards, the Garibaldi expedition to the south, the conquest of Naples, the annexation of Venetia from the Austrians during the War of 1866, and the final unification of Italy with the capture of Rome in 1870, soon overshadowed the Crimean War. These were the defining events of the Risorgimento, the popular resurrection of the nation, by which Italians would come to see the making of modern Italy. As a foreign war led by Piedmont and Cavour, a problematic figure for the populist interpretation of the Risorgimento, the campaign in the Crimea had no great claim for commemoration by Italian nationalists. There were no public demonstrations for the war, no volunteer movements, no great victories or glorious defeats in the Crimea. In Turkey, the Crimean War has been not so much forgotten as obliterated from the nation's historical memory, even though it was there that the war began, and Turkish casualties were as many as 120,000 soldiers, almost half the troops involved, according to official statistics. In Istanbul, there are monuments to the Allied soldiers who fought in the war, but none to the Turks. Until very recently, the war was almost totally ignored by Turkish historiography. It did not fit the nationalist version of Turkish history and fell between the earlier Golden Age of the Ottoman Empire and the later history of Ataturk and the birth of the modern Turkish state. Indeed, if anything, despite its victorious conclusion for the Turks, the war has come to be seen as a shameful period in Ottoman history, a turning point in the decline of the empire, when the state fell into massive debt and became dependent on the Western powers, who turned out to be false friends. History textbooks in most Turkish schools charge the decline of Islamic traditions to the growing intervention of the West in Turkey as a result of the Crimean War. So do the official Turkish military histories, like this one published by the General Staff in 1981, which contains this characteristic conclusion, reflecting many aspects of the deep resentment nationalists and Muslims in Turkey feel towards the West. During the Crimean War, Turkey had almost no real friends in the outside world. Those who appeared to be our friends were not real friends. In this war, Turkey lost its treasury. For the first time, it became indebted to Europe. Even worse, by participating in this war with Western allies, thousands of foreign soldiers and civilians were able to see closely the most secret places and shortcomings of Turkey. Another negative effect of the war was that some semi-intellectual circles of Turkish society came to admire Western fashions and values, losing their identity. The city of Istanbul, with its hospitals, schools, and military buildings, was put at the disposal of the Allied commanders, but the Western armies allowed historic buildings to catch fire through their carelessness. The Turkish people showed their traditional hospitality and opened their seaside villas to the Allied commanders, but the Western soldiers did not show the same respect to the Turkish people or to Turkish graves. The Allies prevented Turkish troops from landing on the shores of the Caucasus to support Shamil's war against the Russians, because this was against their national interests. In sum, Turkish soldiers showed every sign of selflessness and shed their blood on all the fronts of the Crimean War, but our Western allies took all the glory for themselves. The effect of the war in Britain was matched only by its impact in Russia, where the events played a significant role in shaping the national identity. But that role was contradictory. The war was, of course, experienced as a terrible humiliation, inflaming profound feelings of resentment against the West for siding with the Turks. But it also fueled a sense of national pride in the defenders of Sevastopol, a feeling that the sacrifices they made and the Christian motives for which they had fought had turned their defeat into a moral victory. The idea was articulated by the Tsar in his manifesto to the Russians on learning of the fall of Sevastopol. "The defence of Sevastopol is unprecedented in the annals of military history, and it has won the admiration not just of Russia, but of all Europe. The defenders are worthy of their place among those heroes who have brought glory to our fatherland. For 11 months, the Sevastopol garrison withstood the attacks of a stronger enemy against our native land, and in every act it distinguished itself through its extraordinary bravery. Its courageous deeds will always be an inspiration to our troops, who share its belief in providence and in the holiness of Russia's cause. The name of Sevastopol, which has given so much blood, will be eternal, and the memory of its defenders will remain always in our hearts, together with the memory of those Russian heroes who fought on the battlefields of Poltava and Borodino." The heroic status of Sevastopol owed much to the influence of Tolstoy's Sevastopol sketches, which were read by almost the entire Russian literate public in 1855-6. Sevastopol sketches fixed in the national imagination the idea of the city as a microcosm of that special Russian spirit of resilience and courage which had always saved the country when it was invaded by a foreign enemy. As Tolstoy wrote in the closing passage of Sevastopol in December, composed in April 1855 at the height of the siege, "So now you have seen the defenders of Sevastopol on the lines of defence themselves, and you retrace your steps, for some reason paying no attention now to the cannonballs and bullets that continue to whistle across your route all the way back to the demolished theatre, i.e. the city of Sevastopol. And you walk in a state of calm exultation. The one central reassuring conviction you have come away with is that it is quite impossible for Sevastopol ever to be taken by the enemy. Not only that, you are convinced that the strength of the Russian people cannot possibly ever falter, no matter in what part of the world it may be put to the test. This impossibility you have observed, not in that proliferation of traverses, parapets, ingeniously interwoven trenches, mines and artillery pieces, of which you have understood nothing, but in the eyes, words and behaviour, that which is called the spirit of the defenders of Sevastopol. What they do straightforwardly, with so little strain or effort that you are convinced they must be capable of 100 times as much. They could do anything. You realize now that the feeling which drives them has nothing in common with the vain, petty, and mindless emotions you yourself have experienced, but is of an altogether different and more powerful nature. It has turned them into men capable of living with as much calm beneath a hail of cannonballs, faced with 100 chances of death, as people who, like most of us, are faced with only one such chance, and of living in those conditions while putting up with sleeplessness, dirt, and ceaseless hard labour. Men will not put up with terrible conditions like these for the sake of a cross or an honour, or because they have been threatened. There must be another, higher motivation. This motivation is a feeling that surfaces only rarely in the Russian, but lies deeply embedded in his soul. A love of his native land. Only now do the stories of the early days of the siege of Sevastopol, when there were no fortifications, no troops, when there was no physical possibility of holding the town, and there was nevertheless not the slightest doubt that it would be kept from the enemy, of the days when Kornilov, that hero worthy of ancient Greece, would say as he inspected his troops, "We will die, men, rather than surrender Sevastopol." And when our Russian soldiers, unversed in phrase-mongering, would answer, "We will die! Hurrah!" Only now do the stories of those days cease to be a beautiful historic legend and become a reality, a fact. You will suddenly have a clear and vivid awareness that those men you have just seen are the very same heroes who, in those difficult days, did not allow their spirits to sink, but rather felt them rise as they joyfully prepared to die, not for the town, but for their native land. Long will Russia bear the imposing traces of this epic of Sevastopol, the hero of which was the Russian people. The epic of Sevastopol turned defeat into a national triumph for Russia. Sevastopol fell, but it did so with such glory that Russians should take pride in such a fall, which is worth a brilliant victory, wrote a former Decembrist. Upon this grand defeat, the Russians built a patriotic myth, a national narrative of the people's selfless heroism, resilience, and sacrifice. Poets likened it to the patriotic spirit of 1812, as did Alexei Apukhtin in his well-known ballad A Soldier's Song About Sevastopol, 1869, which came to be learned by many Russian schoolboys in the final decades of the 19th century. "The song I'll sing to you, lads, isn't a jolly one. It's not a mighty song of victory, like the one our fathers sang at Borodino, or our grandfathers sang at Ochakov. I'll sing to you of how a cloud of dust swirled up from the southern fields, of how countless enemies disembarked, and how they came and defeated us. But such was our defeat that since then they haven't come back looking for trouble. Such was our defeat that they sailed away with sour faces and bashed noses. I'll sing of how, leaving hearth and home behind, the rich landowner joined the militia, of how the peasant, bidding his wife farewell, came out of his hut to serve as a volunteer. I'll sing of how the mighty army grew, as warriors came, strong as iron and steel, who knew they were heading for death, and how piously did they die. Of how our fair women went as nurses to share their cheerless lot, and how for every inch of our Russian land our foes paid us with their blood. Of how through smoke and fire, grenades thundering and heavy groans all round, redoubts emerged one after another, Like a grim spectre, the bastions grew. And 11 months lasted the carnage, and during all these 11 months, the miraculous fortress shielding Russia buried her courageous sons. Let the song I sing to you not be joyful. It's no less glorious than the song of victory our fathers sang at Borodino, or our grandfathers at Otchakov. This was the context in which Tolstoy wrote his own national epic, War and Peace. Tolstoy's conception of the war against Napoleon as Russia's national awakening, the rediscovery of Russian principles by the Europeanized nobility, and the recognition of the patriotic spirit of the serf soldiers as the basis of a democratic nationhood, was a reflection of his reaction to the heroic deeds of the Russian people during the Crimean War. Written between 1862 and 1865, in the years immediately after the emancipation of the serfs, when Russian liberal society was inspired by ideals of national reform and reconciliation between the landed classes and the peasantry, War and Peace was originally conceived as a Decemberist novel set in the aftermath of the Crimean War. In the novel's early form, The Decemberist, the hero returns after 30 years of exile in Siberia to the intellectual ferment of the late 1850s. A second Alexandrine reign has just begun with the accession of Alexander II to the throne, and once again, as in 1825, high hopes for reform are in the air. But the more Tolstoy researched the Decemberists, the more he realized that their intellectual roots lay in the War of 1812, and so set his novel then. The memory of 1812 was bitterly contested after the Crimean War, which had opened up a new perspective on the national character. Democrats like Tolstoy, inspired by the recent sacrifices of the Russian peasant soldiers, saw 1812 as a people's war, a victory attained by the patriotic spirit of the whole nation. To conservatives, on the other hand, 1812 represented the holy triumph of the Russian autocratic principle, which alone saved Europe from Napoleon. The commemoration of the Crimean War was entangled in a similar ideological conflict. Conservatives and church leaders portrayed it as a holy war, the fulfillment of Russia's divine mission to defend orthodoxy in the broader world. They claimed that this had been achieved with the International Declaration to Protect the Christians of the Ottoman Empire and the Paris Treaty's preservation of the status quo, as the Russians had demanded, in the holy places of Jerusalem and Bethlehem. In their writings and sermons on the war, they described the defenders of the Crimea as selfless and courageous Christian soldiers who had sacrificed their lives as martyrs for the Russian Holy Land. They re-emphasized the sanctity of the Crimea as the place where Christianity had first appeared in Russia. From the moment the war had ended, the monarchy sought to connect its commemoration to the memory of 1812. The Tsar's visit to Moscow following the surrender of Sevastopol was staged as a reenactment of Alexander I's dramatic appearance in the former Russian capital in 1812, when he had been greeted by vast crowds of Muscovites. In 1856, the Tsar delayed his coronation until the anniversary of the Battle of Borodino, Russia's victory against Napoleon in September 1812. It was a symbolic move to compensate for the painful loss of the Crimean War and reunite the people with the monarchy on the basis of a more glorious memory. For the democratic intellectual circles in which Tolstoy moved, however, the thread connecting the Crimean War to 1812 was not the holy mission of the Tsar, but the patriotic sacrifice of the Russian people, who laid down their lives in the defence of their native land. That sacrifice, however, was hard to quantify. No one knew how many soldiers died. Precise figures for Russian casualties were never collected, and any information about heavy losses was distorted or concealed by the Tsarist military authorities. But estimates of the Russians killed during the Crimean War vary between 400,000 and 600,000 men for all theatres of the war. The medical department of the Ministry of War later published a figure of 450,015 deaths in the army for the 4 years between 1853 and 1856. This is probably the most accurate estimate. Without precise figures, the people's sacrifice grew to assume a mythic status in the democratic imagination. Sevastopol itself was elevated to a quasi-sacred site in the collective memory. The veneration of the fallen heroes of the siege began as soon as the war ended, not on the initiative of the government and official circles, but through popular efforts, by families and groups of veterans erecting monuments or founding churches, cemeteries and benevolent funds with money raised from public donations. The focal point of this democratic cult was the commemoration of Admirals Nachimov, Kornilov and Istomin, the popular heroes of Sevastopol. They were idolized as men of the people, devoted to the welfare of their troops, who had all died as martyrs in the defence of the town. In 1856, a national fund was organized to pay for the erection of a monument to the admirals in Sevastopol, and there were similar initiatives in many other towns. Kornilov was the central figure of numerous histories of the war. Nachimov, the hero of Sinope and virtually a saint in the folklore of the siege, appeared in tales and prints as a brave and selfless soldier, a martyr of the people's holy cause, who was ready for his death when he was struck down while inspecting the fourth bastion. It was entirely through private funding that the Museum of the Black Sea Fleet was established in Sevastopol in 1869. On display to the crowds who came on the opening day were various weapons, artifacts and personal items, manuscripts and maps, drawings and engravings collected from veterans. It was the first historical museum of this public nature in Russia. The Russian state became involved in the commemoration of Sevastopol only in the later 1870s, around the time of the Russo-Turkish War, mainly as a result of the growing influence of the Pan-Slavs in government circles, but government initiatives focused on court favourites such as General Gorchakov and virtually neglected the people's hero Nachimov. By this time, the admiral had become an icon of a popular nationalist movement that the regime attempted to subordinate to its own official nationality by building monuments to the Crimean War. In 1905, a year of revolution and war against Japan, a splendid panorama of the defence of Sevastopol was opened to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the siege in a purpose-built museum on a site where the fourth bastion had once stood. Government officials insisted on replacing the portrait of Nachimov with one of Gorchakov in Franz Rubo's life-size painting model, recreating the events of the 18th of June, when the defenders of Sevastopol had repelled the assault by the British and the French. Nachimov did not appear in the museum, which was built upon the very ground where he had been mortally wounded. The Soviet commemoration of the war returned the emphasis to the popular heroes. Nachimov came to stand for the patriotic sacrifice and heroism of the Russian people in the defence of their motherland, a propaganda message that took on a new force during the war of 1941-5. From 1944, Soviet naval officers and sailors were decorated with the Nachimov Medal and trained in special cadet schools established in his name. In books and films, he became a symbol of the great leader rallying the people against an aggressive foreign foe. Production of Cephalot Pudovkin's patriotic film Admiral Nachimov, 1947, began in 1943 when Britain was an ally of the Soviet Union. Planned as a Soviet counterpart to Alexander Korda's wartime epic about Lord Nelson, Lady Hamilton, 1941, its first cut made light of Britain's role as an enemy of Russia during the Crimean War, focusing instead on Nachimov's private life and on his relations with the population of Sevastopol. But as it went through editing, the film got caught up in the opening skirmishes of the Cold War, a conflict that arose in the Turkish Straits and the Caucasus, the starting points of the Crimean War. From the autumn of 1945, the Soviets pushed for a revision of the 1936 Montreux Convention on the Neutrality of the Straits. Stalin demanded joint Soviet-Turkish control of the Dardanelles and the cession to the Soviet Union of Kars and Ardahan, territories conquered by Tsarist Russia but ceded to the Turks in 1922. Mindful of the build-up of Soviet troops in the Caucasus, the United States sent warships to the Eastern Mediterranean in August 1946. It was precisely at this moment that Stalin demanded changes to Potovkin's film. The focus shifted from Nachimov as a man to Nachimov as a military leader against the foreign foe, and Britain was depicted as the enemy of Russia, who had used the Turks to pursue its aggressive imperialist aims in the Black Sea, just as Stalin claimed the Americans were doing in the early stages of the Cold War. A similar patriotic line was taken by the great historian of the Stalin era, Evgeny Tarle, in his two-volume history of the Crimean War, 1941-3, his biography Nachimov, 1948, and in his later book, The City of Russian Glory, Sevastopol in 1854-55, 1955, published to commemorate the centenary. Tarle was very critical of the Tsarist leadership, but he glorified the patriotic courage and resilience of the Russian people, led and inspired by the example of such heroic leaders as Nachimov and Kornilov, who laid down their lives for the defence of Russia against the imperialist aggression of the Western powers. The fact that Russia's enemies in the Crimean War, Britain, France, and Turkey, were now all NATO members and adversaries of the newly founded Warsaw Pact in 1955, added great attention to the Soviet celebration of the war's centenary. Pride in the heroes of Sevastopol, the city of Russian glory, remains an important source of national identity, although today it is situated in a foreign land, a result of the transfer of the Crimea to Ukraine by Nikita Khrushchev in 1954, and the declaration of Ukrainian independence on the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991. In the words of one Russian nationalist poet, "On the ruins of our superpower, there is a major paradox of history. Sevastopol, the city of Russian glory, is outside Russian territory." The loss of the Crimea has been a severe blow to the Russians, already suffering a loss of national pride after the collapse of the Soviet Empire. Nationalists have actively campaigned for the Crimea to return to Russia, not least nationalists in Sevastopol itself, which remains an ethnic Russian town. Memories of the Crimean War continue to stir profound feelings of Russian pride and resentment of the West. In 2006, a conference on the Crimean War was organized by the Center of National Glory of Russia with the support of Vladimir Putin's presidential administration and the ministries of education and defense. The conclusion of the conference, issued by its organizers in a press release, was that the war should be seen not as a defeat for Russia, but as a moral and religious victory, a national act of sacrifice in a just war. Russians should honor the authoritarian example of Nicholas I, a Tsar unfairly derided by the liberal intelligentsia for standing up against the West in the defense of his country's interests. The reputation of Nicholas I, the man who led the Russians into the Crimean War against the world, has been restored in Putin's Russia. Today, on Putin's orders, Nicholas's portrait hangs in the antechamber of the presidential office in the Kremlin. At the end of the Crimean War, 250,000 Russians had been buried in mass graves in various locations around Sevastopol. All around the battle sites of Inkerman and Alma, the Chernaya Valley, Balaclava and Sevastopol, there are unknown soldiers buried underground. In August 2006, the remains of 14 Russian infantrymen from the Vladimir and Kazan regiments were discovered not far from the spot where they were killed during the battle at the Alma. Alongside their skeletons were their knapsacks, water bottles, crucifixes and grenades. The bones were reburied with military honours in a ceremony attended by Ukrainian and Russian officials at the Museum of the Alma near Bakhchisarai, and there are plans in Russia to build a chapel on the site. This has been an Audible Studios production of Crimea, written by Orlando Figes, performed by Malk Williams. Copyright 2010 by Orlando Figes. Production copyright 2018 by Audible Limited. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.